internet is that massive computer network, the one that's becoming really big now.
The Oklahoma City bombing stands as the deadliest domestic terror attack in U.S. history.
Xena provokes strong emotions among those who cross her path.
Because I'll come over there and jam an oar up your ass!
The trial of O.J. Simpson is over. He is not guilty.
Oh my God, I'm totally bugging.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you.
To infinity and beyond!
And isn't it ironic?
Consider these ironies that happened in 1995, Clef. The worst terrorist attack on American soil up to 1995 was committed by Americans. And this one. The internet exploded in popularity in 1995, but one of the most popular films that year was about the nostalgia of playing with old-fashioned toys.
I have considered them, and I deem them indeed ironic.
All right.
Much more ironic than the so-called ironies that Alanis Morissette
posed in her song Ironic.
Right.
Which is a song that, in fact, we'll be covering later in the show.
Welcome to Yearview Mirror with Ken and Cliff. I am Cliff. Ken and I are a couple of high school history teachers that discuss, debate, and deprecate each other's thoughts and ideas about U.S. history and popular culture.
And in each episode, we aim to create a big picture snapshot of one year in post-World War II America by using significant historical events to contextualize a handful of films, TV shows, and songs. We are profiling 1995 in this show, and we'll be discussing three films, the wacky comedy Tommy Boy, the teenage dramedy Clueless, and the feature animation film Toy Story.
For television, it was pretty thin that year, so we'll only be discussing the fantasy series Xena, Warrior Princess, which illustrates just how thin the year was for TV debuts. And for music, we'll hear songs from the Goo Goo Dolls, Coolio, Oasis, and Alanis Morissette. But first, let's recap the top historical events from 1995. After almost a year, the racially charged trial of former NFL superstar O.J. Simpson came to an end. The jury found Simpson not guilty of the murders of his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ron Goldman. The decision sparked widespread controversy and outrage, with many believing Simpson never received a fair trial due to his celebrity status and racial bias in the justice system. However, in the end, the glove never fit, and Simpson's acquittal exposed deep racial divisions in America and raised questions about the fairness of the justice system.
The worst terrorist act in American history occurred in 1995 when Timothy McVeigh, fueled by anti-government rage, detonated a massive truck bomb outside the federal building in downtown Oklahoma City. The explosion ripped through the nine-story structure, destroying most of it and causing severe damage to surrounding buildings. 168 people, including 19 children in a daycare center, lost their lives that day. The Oklahoma City bombing remains the deadliest act of domestic terrorism in U.S. history, exposing the dangers of anti-government extremism.
After nearly 4 years of brutal conflict, the Bosnian War in Eastern Europe came to an end with the signing of a peace treaty in late 1995. The war was rooted in deep-seated ethnic and religious tensions between Muslims, Serbs, and Catholic Croatians. The U.S. participated in the NATO-led effort to end the conflict and played a key role in peacekeeping after the war's end. The war resulted in the deaths of an estimated 100,000 people and the displacement of millions more.
1995 was the year I and millions of other Americans first got on the internet. The internet had been around in various forms the previous 25 years or so, but 1995 marked significant technological advancements. The release of Windows 95 with built-in internet access and the growing popularity of web browsers like Netscape Navigator made the internet more user-friendly and accessible to a wider audience. This laid the groundwork, of course, for the internet's explosive growth in the late 1990s and its transformation into the essential communication and information tool it is today. And just a personal aside here, Cliff, 1995 was the year that I got a job with Disney Online in North Hollywood, California, and helped them launch their online business. I literally signed up for America Online a week before my interview with Disney, and they had the audacity to still hire me.
And you just signed up.
And I had literally signed up the week before.
You've led a charmed life, Ken. A charmed life. I was a junior, then senior in college in 1995, Ken. And like you, that year marked the first time I came into contact with the internet. Meeting with my anthropology professor about an upcoming paper, she lectured me about how I needed to get with the program and get on the net. So with the help of a computer science friend of mine, I took her advice and went to one of the only two computer labs on campus at the time and did research for my paper on the internet. I believe I got an A on that paper, by the way.
So in my research on the films of 1995, there was some conflict in which movie was the top-grossing film that year. One site said that it was Die Hard with a Vengeance, and another said Toy Story. You ever see Die Hard with a Vengeance? Any good?
No, I've only saw the first two.
Yeah. I never saw the Die Hard sequel, but I did see Toy Story about 47 times. It was one of my son's favorite movies, and it has since become a landmark film in the history of feature animation. So let's start there.
Toy Story was the first entirely computer animated feature film, as well as the first feature film from Pixar Studios. Pixar was created in 1986 by Steve Jobs and John Lasseter, who directed Toy Story. Over the course of 8 years, Pixar developed proprietary animation software that pushed the envelope of computer animation. In 1988, Lasseter and his team released a short film, Tin Toy, to enormous acclaim and success. Pixar and Disney entered into a partnership agreement to co-finance and distribute three computer animated films, with Toy Story being the first collaboration. Disney provided crucial financial support and distribution expertise, while Pixar brought cutting-edge technology and creative storytelling to the table. Using Tin Toy as inspiration, Disney and Pixar collaborated on the story of a world where toys come alive when humans are absent. Woody, the cowboy, the favorite toy of young Andy, fears being replaced by a new Space Ranger action figure, Buzz Lightyear. But by the end, they ultimately learn to work together to protect Andy's happiness. Let's listen to a short clip from the film's original trailer.
Sergeant?
Yes, sir.
Establish a recon post downstairs.
Code Red!
Star Command, come in. Do you read me?
The story of two toys. Oh.
There seems to be no sign of intelligent life anywhere.
Hello?
Who ya? Ah!
Headed for a showdown.
My name is Woody. This is my spot.
Ah!
I am Buzz Lightyear. I come in peace.
You are a child's plaything!
You are a sad, strange little man.
So just a quick history lesson here. Up to this point in animation history, all films and TV shows were animated by hand, with an army of illustrators creating frame-by-frame images on transparent sheets of celluloid, or also known as cells. These cells are then layered on top of background images and photographed in sequence to create the illusion of movement when played back at normal speed. Disney Studios was the first company to release a feature animation film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, back in 1937.
Fast forward to the early 1990s, it took over 4 years to create Toy Story, primarily because of the limitations of computing power back then. The finished film required over 800,000 machine hours and 114,240 frames of animation in total. Despite the technological hurdles, what distinguishes Toy Story as a cherished classic is that it's a great story that young and old can appreciate. The film grossed over $375 million, making it the most commercially successful animated film at that time. It generated four sequels, Toy Story 2, Toy Story 3, Toy Story 4, and Lightyear.
And I think Toy Story 5 is actually going to come out in 2026, they just announced.
Oh, thank the baby Jesus.
Yeah.
I can't wait. And beyond its initial theatrical success, Toy Story continued to generate revenue through various merchandising ventures totaling over $10 billion over the last 29 years.
The irony of Toy Story is that it's a story about old-fashioned toys becoming obsolete in the face of a high-tech space hero with electronic bells and whistles. Much like, at that time, the obsolescence of analog communication in the face of a new digital online communication medium, the internet. Toy Story perfectly taps into the anxieties of this historical transition from old to new. I'll never forget logging on to America Online back in 1995, and for those of you too young to know, America Online was really the first major online provider back in 1995. Now they're nothing. Once you subscribed and plugged your 14.4K modem into your computer, that distinctive sound of it opened the digital door to a brand new world. And for me, It seemed like science fiction. I remember thinking back then that if I didn't accept that Disney Online job, I was going to be left in the analog dust. So I jumped on board and kind of felt like Buzz Lightyear, leaving behind my old-fashioned friends and family.
Beyond the technological conflict of Toy Story remains a profoundly human story of friendship, loyalty, sacrifice, and childhood wonder, which speaks to literally everyone, except maybe me. Woody wasn't the only one who feared being replaced in 1995. However, instead of fighting that fear or ignoring it, Woody's acceptance of Buzz Lightyear assures his relevance.
I know you're not a big animation guy, Cliff, but you got to admit, Toy Story had a very tender, heart-wrenching story.
I would admit no such thing.
Well, get out of here. This really sets a new low for you, from my perspective. For you not to be able to see the glory,
no glory.
And brilliance of Toy Story is just sheer ignorance on your part.
When I was a child, I spake as a child.
You spake?
It's spake.
Yeah,
this is what the Bible says.
What the hell does spake?
The Bible says.
What the hell kind of language are you speaking?
When I was a child, I spake as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things.
Then you know what? That's why you're too old at your young age now to be able to not revel in the youthfulness of animation.
Okay, it's a cartoon. Get over it. We also need to acknowledge Toy Story's influence on the entertainment industry overall. Toy Story proved that computerized animation can be profitable, and literally hundreds of digitally animated feature films have been released since. As of the spring of 2024, there have been 5 digitally animated feature films that have earned over $1 billion. Unbelievable. Toy Story not only revolutionized digital animation, it pushed the boundaries of how computers can transform visual storytelling.
Another film from 1995 that provided an even more accurate reflection of 1990s culture was the coming-of-age teen comedy Clueless. It was written and directed by Amy Heckerling, and it starred Alicia Silverstone as the central character. It's a very loose adaptation of Jane Austen's 1815 novel, Emma. The plot centers on a beautiful, popular, and rich high school student who befriends a new student and decides to give her a makeover while playing matchmaker for her teachers, all of which forces her to examine her own existence. I first saw this in the theater with Stacy. I was surprised how well this film held up after the course of almost 29 years. What Mean Girls was for the 2000s and what Fast Times at Ridgemont High or The Breakfast Club was for the 80s, Clueless defined high school movies in the 1990s. It captured the style and mentality of the 90s better than anything else and introduced the world to Paul Rudd, who is the only cast member to remain a big star 29 years later. I love Paul Rudd.
Let's listen to a short clip from the film's original trailer.
Mr. Hall was way harsh. He gave me a C minus.
Well, he gave me a C, which drags down my entire average.
Ew, get off of me.
Cher's got attitude about high school boys.
It's a personal choice every woman has got to make for themselves.
Cher is saving herself for Luke Perry.
Cher, you're a virgin?
I mean, I'm not prude. I'm just highly selective.
My plastic surgeon doesn't want me doing any activity where balls fly at my nose.
Well, there goes your social life.
Cliff, you turned 21 in 1995, but how well do you think this movie captured being young in the 1990s?
I think it captured being young in the 90s pretty well.
Okay.
The film explores themes of social hierarchy and cliquishness within the high school setting, reflecting broader concerns about peer pressure and conformity during the 1990s. The film's portrayal of the various cliques and social circles within the school, from the popular plastics to the misfit skaters, speaks to the complexities of teenage social dynamics and the desire to belong. Yet it also challenges these norms by depicting characters who defy stereotypes and forge genuine connections across social boundaries. The film also reflects the increasing influence of technology and media on teenage life in the 1990s. The characters in the film are depicted as being highly connected and informed, with Cher and her friends constantly using their cell phones, pagers, and computers to communicate and stay up to date on the latest trends and gossip. She even has her clothes in a computer database, which she uses every day to match that day's outfit.
You know, that was one of the things that really struck me in the film when seeing it this time, because you and I, of course, have seen a generation of kids completely obsessed with their digital devices into the 21st century. But this film was shot in 1994, came out in 95. You know, cell phones were available, but not to the extent that people have become so obsessed with them today. And clearly it was a class distinction, whereas Cher came from a very wealthy family to be able to have a phone. One of the things I couldn't help think about while watching this as a 63-year-old high school teacher was how Cher reflected the changing gender dynamics of the 1990s. Yes, to a certain degree, she was kind of that classic, stereotypical, bubbly blonde, and she was definitely ignorant to the world outside her upper-class bubble. However, Cher and her friends were depicted as assertive and self-assured individuals who pursued their own interests and ambitions. They rejected narrow notions of femininity and instead embraced their individuality. She prioritizes fashion, popularity, and attracting the right kind of boyfriend. However, I didn't think the movie glorified that superficiality. How about you, Cliff? Any thoughts on that?
No, it definitely didn't glorify it. Instead, her superficiality was depicted in a way that let the audience know we were supposed to laugh at it. At the film's start, Cher is totally clueless about what really matters in life, but as the movie progresses, she stops being so superficial and, to borrow a phrase from MTV's The Real World, starts getting real.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the more compelling aspects of the story for me, is that although Cher sort of played this classic character that you would have thought is someone that you would have normally despised if you were in high school, unless you were part of Cher's circle, the fact that she goes through this narrative arc and sort of realizes that she is the one that is in fact clueless to the real world, I thought was a nice little summation of the story's themes.
Yeah, and when she discovers that she's the one who's clueless, that paves the way for her to get Paul Rudd in the end.
Yes, there you go. Cliff, when we were discussing what movies to cover for 1995, I initially dismissed this next film as just another stupid comedy that was nothing more than an extended Saturday Night Live skit. But as I rewatched Tommy Boy for like the eighth time, because I love this movie, I found some themes in it that made me think this was more than just a comedic vehicle for Chris Farley. I should also note, I laughed as hard on my eighth viewing of this as I did when I saw it the first time. I mean, this is a frickin' funny-ass movie, Cliff.
Yes, it definitely is, Ken. Chris Farley, he truly shines in it, and I found it as funny now as I did when I first saw it. Maybe even funnier.
Yeah.
Tommy Boy was written by Bonnie and Terry Turner and directed by Peter Siegel. It was produced by Lorne Michaels, the creator and long-running producer of Saturday Night Live. The film starred two SNL castmates, Chris Farley as the lead and David Spade as his childhood friend. The story centers on Tommy Callahan, played by Farley, the son of a successful auto parts manufacturer who dies suddenly, leaving Tommy and the entire town where the factory is located in an uncertain future. Let's listen to a short clip from the film's original trailer.
You know, a lot of people go to college for 7 years.
I know. They're called doctors.
This always has been, always will be, a family firm.
Oh, son of a...
Someday my son will run it.
Luke. Luke. I am your father.
Promise me you'll look after Tommy Boy here till he gets his feet wet.
Sure, and thanks for choosing me.
I'm a maniac on the floor.
Let's first and foremost establish that Tommy Boy is first and foremost a comedy and absolutely Chris Farley's best movie performance in his way too short career. And we'll get more into Farley in a bit. But I wanted to discuss a couple of things about this movie that I found very interesting about American culture in the 1990s. The film kicks off with Tommy's graduation from college.
On the 7 year plan, by the way.
I know, 7 years. On the ride back home with Richard, played by David Spade, Tommy observes that much of his hometown has been shuttered with numerous factories closed and out of business. The late 80s and 1990s marked a significant period of decline in America's manufacturing sector, especially in the Rust Belt of Middle America as depicted in Tommy Boy. One primary reason for the decline was the intensification of globalization and the emergence of low-cost manufacturing hubs in countries like China, Mexico, and other parts of Asia. American manufacturers faced increasing competition from overseas firms that could produce goods at much lower costs due to cheap labor, less stringent regulations, and favorable trade policies. This led to a loss of market share for American manufacturers, particularly in industries such as textiles, electronics, and the automotive business, like Callahan Auto Parts in Tommy Boy. After Tommy's father dies, his company becomes a target for corporate takeover, and the threat of shutting the factory and the entire town down becomes imminent. Tommy steps up and commits to sell the necessary auto parts to keep the factory open, but he's pretty much an imbecile, and that's where the madcap hilarity kicks in when Tommy and Richard set out across Middle America in search of sales. Tommy's struggles represents the anxieties of a generation facing an uncertain job market with fewer opportunities in traditional blue-collar sectors.
As you noted, Ken, Tommy is pretty much incompetent, but he begins to learn the art of sales from Richard. And that becomes one of the more endearing parts of the story. We know Tommy's a bumbling imbecile. In fact, the entire town knows it. But he begins to learn about business and maximize the skills he does have. Let's listen to a clip when Tommy reveals to a diner waitress why he sucks at sales.
Let's say I go into some guy's office. Let's say he's even remotely interested in buying something. Well, then I get all excited. I'm like Jojo, the idiot circus boy with a pretty new pet. The pet is my possible sale. So I stroke it and I pet it. And then I take my naughty pet and I go... Oh, I killed it! I killed my sale!
It's a pivotal moment in the film because Richard sees that Tommy's seeming incompetency has endeared the waitress into turning the fryer back on so Tommy can get the wings that he initially wanted. He sold the waitress by using his self-deprecating manner and comedic confidence. It's from this point in the film Tommy becomes the salesman we never thought he'd ever become. While initially resistant to responsibility, Tommy ultimately embraces hard work and problem solving to save the business. This shift reflects the emphasis on career success and personal drive that became prominent in the economic boom of the late 1990s.
We should provide some background to Chris Farley, who I believe was one of the most talented performers to appear on Saturday Night Live. He grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, and eventually worked his way to the famous Second City Theater Improvisation Group in Chicago, starting on the same day, by the way, as Stephen Colbert. He joined Saturday Night Live in 1990 and quickly became one of the top performers on the show. The dude was hilarious, but after 5 seasons on SNL, he was let go, giving him more opportunities to appear in films.
Cliff, you already know this story, but I gotta share it with the audience here because of all the celebrities I've had the opportunity to meet over the years, and I've been lucky to meet a lot of celebrities. Meeting Chris Farley at a Grammy Awards party in 1994 is still my favorite celebrity run-in story. So here it is. I was leaving the party with Stacy, and I saw that Farley was coming right towards me. I was frozen, starstruck. He was kind of dressed like Matt Foley with those stupid glasses, but just as he was about to pass me, I stopped him, shook his hand, and thanked him for making me laugh so hard. In front of everybody, he pushed his glasses up on his nose and yelled in the voice of Matt Foley so loud that it stopped everything that was going on. And he says, "That's the nicest thing anybody said to me all night." We shook hands and he disappeared into the party. I was elated. Less than 4 years later, Farley was dead from an apparent drug overdose and an unhealthy heart. My heart was broken. I still think he's one of the funniest people I've ever seen in my life. Any closing thoughts, Cliff?
You know, Chris Farley was pure comedic gold. There's no doubt about it. But I wonder if the fact that most of the laughs he got, both in Tommy Boy and on SNL, were due to his weight actually bothered him. It's one thing to have people laughing with you and a totally other thing to have people laughing at you. Your thoughts on this, Ken?
There was talk
talk, and even David Spade reaffirmed this in interviews after Farley's death, that he was very, very self-conscious about his weight and the fact that people were laughing at him as a result of his appearance and not necessarily his comedy always weighed on him very, very heavily. And I'm sure that would be a very difficult thing to do. But it was interesting, even in that little run-in that I had with him at that Grammys party, the fact that he was able to so quickly step into a role that he had become so famous for and sort of in a real moment of fan celebrity gesture, he steps into the character of Matt Foley. You know, he realized that, you know, that's how I will always remember him, and that's how he wanted to sort of present himself to me. At the end of the day, it's just another tragic celebrity story of someone, you know, wasting their talent. I mean, who knows what he could have done after, instead of dying, I mean, going on to do just more funny stuff. I guess his demons got the better of him. Bummer.
It is a bummer. Let's move over to the television of 1995. By the start of the year, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox remained the major players, but cable was quickly gaining ground. About 56% of American homes subscribed to cable television at the start of 1995, and that number would increase by 10 percentage points each year for the next several years. Seinfeld, Friends, and ER were the most successful TV shows that year.
And for reasons I cannot figure, the TV debuts that year were very mediocre. Nothing really of significant note or lasting value. However, there was one which definitely said something about changing demographics and 90s feminism, and we'll get to that in a bit. However, we should also acknowledge the fact that 1995 was the year Japanese anime exploded in popularity in the U.S. Three anime series debuted on American television in 1995: Sailor Moon, Naruto, and Dragon Ball Z. I'm sure you've seen all three of those animes.
Seen them. I've lived them, Ken.
Neither of us are anime fans, Cliff. You can't fool me. But we need to acknowledge those series and the explosion of anime properties that followed as significant contributors to global pop culture. I just don't know enough about anime to speak about it in depth. So I asked my youngest son, Lucas, who's a big anime fan, to explain why he and hundreds of millions of young people love anime so much. And here's what he told me. First, anime typically features very well-developed characters and explores complex themes such as friendship, perseverance, identity, and the human condition. There's clearly a unique visual style to anime that sets it apart from Western animation, with visually stunning scenes and dynamic action sequences. And this is the one that I think really reflects a bigger story about how globalization has been embraced by the millennial generation. He claims anime provides a fascinating window into a different cultural perspective. He loves Japanese culture and has now put Tokyo as the number one global destination on his bucket list of places to visit.
As you noted, there was one television debut in 1995 that captured changing demographics and 90s feminism. Xena, Warrior Princess, was a fantasy television series that spun off from another fantasy series, Hercules, The Legendary Journeys. Xena was filmed entirely on location in New Zealand, and it followed Xena, played by Lucy Lawless, an infamous warrior looking to be redeemed for her past sins against the innocent by using her formidable fighting skills to aid those who are defenseless and in need of saving. Xena's companion and soulmate, Gabrielle, helped Xena in recognizing and pursuing the greater good. The series aired in more than 100 countries, and in its second season, it became the top-rated syndicated series on American television. It ran for 6 seasons and remained in the top 5 for all 6 seasons. TV syndication, for those that don't know, means it was made by a production company but not supported by a specific network. Instead, bought by various second-tier networks. Not being subject to network scrutiny gave the show a certain creative freedom. Let's hear a compilation of 2 promos used for the series' premiere season.
An all-new series.
Celebrate your dark side. Don't run away from it.
In a hero's world, you must make a choice.
There's no rest for the wicked.
He's a scary guy.
For honor.
Is one woman too much for you?
At any price. Kill the first one that touches the ground. Lucy Lawless is a new kind of hero.
Sometimes you have to stand and fight.
Xena is brave. She's beautiful. Ready to bear arms to the death.
Oh my God, Cliff, this series was just so freaking awful and so overly campy that it bordered
on the hilarious. Now, keep in mind, Cliff, I was 35 when Xena premiered, and I was never much into fantasy TV or film for that matter, so this series was just never going to appeal to me. However, even watching a couple of episodes for this podcast, I was amazed this series was as globally successful as it was, but I think Xena and the explosion of anime in the late 1990s actually had a lot in common. Both Xena and Japanese anime featured strong and empowered female heroines. Xena was a formidable warrior who fought against injustice and oppression. Similarly, anime series like Sailor Moon and Revolutionary Girl Utena showcased powerful female characters who challenged traditional roles and stereotypes. Xena and Japanese anime often featured action-packed and adventurous storylines. Whether it was epic battles, daring quests, or supernatural encounters, these narratives captured audiences with their thrilling action sequences. Both Xena and anime drew inspiration from various mythological and historical sources, blending elements of fantasy with ancient Greek, Roman, and Japanese mythology. Both Xena and anime developed dedicated fan bases and cult followings. Fans of these shows were crazy passionate about their favorite characters and storylines, leading to the creation of fan communities, conventions, fan fiction, and fan art. But most importantly, it was the proliferation of cable and VHS tapes that fueled the rise of alternative and niche TV programming, like anime and fantasy in the late 90s. The expanding global reach of television and the internet allowed these shows to attract audiences beyond their respective countries of origin, contributing to their widespread popularity and enduring legacy.
We would be remiss if we didn't touch on the feminist and LGBTQ themes in Xena. Xena was a powerful and independent female character who challenged traditional gender roles. She was skilled in combat, led her own army, and embarked on quests to right wrongs and seek redemption for her past misdeeds. Her character represented a departure from the typical female roles seen on television at the time. Xena embodied empowerment and agency, encouraging viewers to embrace their own strength and abilities regardless of gender. Her journey of redemption and self-discovery resonated with audiences, particularly women, who saw in her a symbol of resilience and determination. Xena is also a lesbian icon.
I know, I heard about this, I read about this.
By the end of the series, we knew that she and Gabrielle were soulmates and were married in a different life. And the two share a few kisses throughout the course of the show. Now, Ken, let me tell you about Xena, the Warrior Princess. You know, okay. I am a fan of fantasy, particularly in books, more so than in TV shows or movies. But this show, and the fact that she was a lesbian icon and there was going to be, you know, some questionable kissy-kissy action between her and another character, right. Plus she's running around in a short skirt and, you know, a bustier.
No, she's very sexy.
Like, I thought, well, after I've watched the first episode, that, you know, this was something I definitely wanted to keep watching.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That first episode seemed to go on for hours.
Yeah.
It was so bad.
Yeah. But yet, I do think that there is an interesting parallel with this explosion of anime that I think has something to do with this, is that this fantasy, this need, this compulsion of the global audience to sort of escape into these silly mythological stories that are just so poorly executed was an interesting reflection of sort of that globalization and sort of lack of distinction of what is quality TV for the global TV audience.
Right.
Let's move over to music in 1995. By 1995, much to Cliff's delight, grunge was dead. Kurt Cobain from Nirvana died the year before in 1994, and many grunge bands had broken up. However, grunge would fuel the rise of alternative rock, which we'll hear in a couple of the songs that we've selected for this show. Hip-hop continued to grow in popularity, with artists like Tupac, Notorious B.I.G., and Nas dominating the charts. Gangsta rap, however, faced strong criticism for its violent lyrics and portrayal of inner-city struggles.
However, the first song we're going to cover toned down the more violent aspects of gangsta rap and ended up being the number one year-ending song of 1995. Finally, we get a year-ending song that's actually a good song.
Yeah.
Gangsta Gangster's Paradise by the artist Coolio sampled Stevie Wonder's 1976 song Pastime Paradise and featured guest vocals from singer LV, who also collaborated on the song's lyrics and composition. The song was most famously used in the 1995 film Dangerous Minds, starring Michelle Pfeiffer. In that film, Pfeiffer played an ex-Marine who teaches in an inner-city community and uses education to elevate the lives of her students. Sounds like the plot of our teaching in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Yeah, but you look nothing like Michelle Pfeiffer.
No, I actually look in some ways better.
Nevertheless, it was the first serious rap song to top the UK and US charts, opening the door for artists like Tupac and the Notorious B.I.G., who up to that point were considered just too abrasive for the mainstream. I think one of the reasons this song achieved so much success back then was that it didn't contain any foul language or overly violent ideas, and we have Stevie Wonder actually to thank about that. When Coolio's record company approached Wonder for his approval to use the song, Pastime Paradise, he insisted on no foul language. Coolio complied and the song became a crossover hit. Cliff, as you well know, given the numerous stories that we've heard from many of our students here in Bridgeport, Connecticut, the inner city can be a hopeless place and the daily struggle to survive in a hostile environment can be an oppressive and depressing thing.
And I think it just tells a very real story. It's not like all the other gangster rap that came before it, where you've got the rapper who all they can do is brag about how tough they are, how cool they are, how good they are with their nines.
Right.
Here, instead, we've got a gangster who is saying the paradise is not, it's tongue-in-cheek there. It's not really a paradise for these gangsters. They don't know if they're going to live from age 23 to 24.
Right.
Like, they have no idea what's going to happen. They're living by their guns, essentially.
Right.
And at any moment, they can drop dead. And I think audiences, for maybe the first time, a lot of primarily maybe white, older audiences listen to a song like a gangster rap song like Gangster's Paradise. It made them think about the actual gangsters.
Yes.
That people who live and die in the streets, their lives can't be very good.
Very big fan of this next song, Wonderwall, by the British group Oasis. In fact, the whole record this song came from, What's the Story, Morning Glory, was one of my most played records back in the 1995-1996 timeframe. The song was written by lead guitarist and chief songwriter Noel Gallagher.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you.
Oasis was part of a bigger musical trend happening in the 1990s called Britpop, with bands like The Verve, Pulp, and the Stone Roses. It was sort of the UK's answer to American grunge, and Oasis, to me, was the best of the bunch. They had a unique blend of British pop sensibilities, guitar-driven rock, and working-class themes. There was a stylish, rawer edge to Britpop that set it apart from the previous British music trends like punk and new wave. How about you, Cliff? Were you a fan of Wonderwall?
I thought it was a fairly decent song, and I really dug the opening, but I prefer Don't Look Back in Anger from the same album so much more.
Yeah.
That song's a fucking gem, Ken.
Yeah.
The media speculated that Wonderwall was about Noel Gallagher's then-girlfriend, later wife, and their splintering relationship at the time. However, Gallagher claims the song describes an imaginary friend who's going to come and save you from yourself.
I went back and listened to all of What's the Story, Morning Glory, and it holds up still very, very strongly. And it really bums me out that Oasis, as a result of Noel Gallagher and his brother Liam, the fact that they just fought incessantly and never were able to sort of keep their musical legacy moving forward, really bummed me out, because I really thought they were spectacular.
You know, Wonderwall is the only song from the 20th century to be featured in the top 100 most streamed songs on the platform.
It's remarkable that it, obviously, that speaks to the fact that even newer generations can embrace this song.
Liam Gallagher, though, was not a big fan of the song. He once admitted to MTV News, quote, "Every time I have to sing it, I want to gag." He then went on to say, quote, "Problem is, it was a big, big tune for us.
Yeah.
Unquote, which means, you know, he had to.
He's still raking in the royalties.
Oasis, with the launch of this album and this song, were compared by a lot of critics to the Beatles.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You, as a super huge Beatles
fan.
I
think that's one of the reasons why I was such a big fan of Oasis. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily strong references to Beatles' past catalog, but there was a reverence in their compositions that sort of spoke to a very big, slick, big sound, which yes. The Beatles got very well known for in the latter half mm-hmm. of their tenure. It's also interesting that Wonderwall is a clear acknowledgement of George Harrison's record company called Wonderwall. George Harrison, when he went solo, created his own record company and called it Wonderwall.
And wasn't
Records.
His first solo album
was Wonderwall.
Came out in 68.
Yeah, so it's clear that the Oasis was very, very respectful of the Beatles, and I love that because I love the Beatles.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
This next song reminds me of my fall semester senior year in college, as it seemed to play endlessly from the jukebox in the bar I practically lived in.
Yeah.
The bar was called Maxie's, by the
okay.
way. The song is Name by the Goo Goo Dolls.
I was shocked that Name, the song that we're listening to right now, was not the most streamed song by the Goo Goo Dolls. How the song Iris, which came off of their follow-up album after Name, which has 1.6 billion streams, which puts it in one of the most streamed songs on the Spotify platform. But Name is the third most streamed song from the band, and I think this was their creative peak.
Yeah, this was their best.
The song itself, Name, has this interesting composition to it, which is driven by acoustic guitars, you know, very emotive vocals by the lead singer, who I actually think had a decent rock voice.
Yes, Johnny Resnick has that kind of gravelly voice.
Yeah. And it's a formula that I think you're going to hear in subsequent songs that come out in the late 90s. I won't tell your name.
And I never knew what it really was about. And it wasn't until now we decided to cover it for this podcast that I realized that it's a story of missed opportunities and lost dreams. In a time when the economy was booming and society seemed to have more opportunities than ever before, the song's message resonated with many people who felt left behind or had experienced personal losses. Apparently, Johnny Resnick, the lead singer, wrote this about his childhood, and he sings it to his sisters who's raised him. Both his parents died when he was young, and his father was an alcoholic. The line, "We're grown-up orphans who never knew their names," reflects
his own past. Interesting.
You know, I don't know how much you've listened to Goo Goo Doll albums, but they're strange because they're kind of split half and half.
Okay.
The bass player, whose name I do not know, writes songs as well, and they're like rockin' kind of songs,
mm-hmm.
like kind of punk kind
mm-hmm.
of songs.
Mm-hmm.
And then Resnick also writes songs, mm-hmm. and all of Resnick's songs are their hits,
mm-hmm.
but they sound like two different bands. I mean, from track to track, you'll be like, who am I listening to now?
Interesting.
Like, it's like, oh, this is Goo Goo Dolls, the bass player, or it's Goo Goo Dolls, Resnick. And you must wonder how that bass player must feel when all of their big hits were written by Resnick and all of their no hits were written by him. I fell in love with this next artist, Alanis Morissette, whose third studio album, Jagged Little Pill, became one of the best-selling albums of all time. She was angry, she was sexual, and she was hot in a normal girl kind of way. Plus, she was born only 3 days before me. You know, and I imagined her and I as a couple.
Oh, really?
And her being pissed off at me for being down at the bar all the time, and then she would turn that anger into great songs that were basically all about me. I thought that would have been a great life for us.
Yeah, that's an interesting fantasy you got there, Cliff. Hey, listen, I was never much of a fan of Jagged Little Pill. I was 35 in 1995. I had a kid with another one on the way. An album from an angsty female Canadian singer-songwriter just never appealed to me at that time, but I definitely liked, of course, the more infectious songs from that album, like my favorites Hand in My Pocket and Head Over Feet. But here's the thing. I was so intrigued by listening to Jagged Little Pill in preparation for this show that I actually went back and listened to her previous album that came out before Jagged Little Pill, and then listened to the two albums that followed Jagged Little Pill. The album that came before Jagged Little Pill is absolutely nothing like Jagged Little Pill. It kind of sounds like Paula Abdul dance crap, but the fact that she abandoned that dance pop sound and recorded an angry rock record that captured the angst of relationship heartbreak and did it with this sort of raucous, snarling attitude was something that I argue just did not exist before Jagged Little Pill. And I don't want to make this a gender thing, but the songs on Jagged Little Pill speak very much to females and feminist-leaning ideas. Most of the female singer-songwriters before 1995 were more folk-oriented, like Joni Mitchell, Tori Amos, or Tracy Chapman, or more dance-pop-oriented songs from artists like Madonna, Cher, or Mariah Carey. You had a couple of successful female rockers in the 1980s, like Pat Benatar, Chrissy Hynde from The Pretenders, or Joan Jett, but those artists never wrote songs anything like what was on Jagged Little Pill. She was really the first woman to break the stereotype of women in music at the mainstream level.
Yeah, and as you mentioned earlier in the show, by 1995, grunge was basically dead. But angst remained a mainstay of a lot of the alternative bands that made it post-grunge.
Right.
Angst, however, wasn't really a component of the music women in rock made over the decades.
Correct.
But then Sinead O'Connor came on the scene.
I'm so glad you acknowledged Sinead.
She came on the scene in the late 80s, early 90s, and now we had a woman who wasn't just angsty, but also downright angry playing on our radios. Sinead thus showed the way for Alanis Morissette to say what she really felt, and she did so on Jagged Little Pill, which in turn inspired other female artists like Avril Lavigne and Fiona Apple to put their own anger into their music. Reveal our favorite personal media releases from 1995. I'll go first. 1995 was, in my opinion, a great year for movies.
It really was.
And I couldn't pick just one of them, so I'm just going to give a shout out to my favorites. Heat.
Don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat around a corner.
Murder in the First.
You don't know what it's like.
Well, what's like?
Alcatraz!
Seven.
Oh, what's in the box?
Braveheart.
That they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
The Usual Suspects.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
And finally, Showgirls. No audio clip for this one, as this is just one of those films that needs to be seen, if you know what I mean, Ken. How about you? What did you pick?
Well, I actually picked two. I chose the film Dead Man, a quirky, very quirky revisionist western by the equally quirky director Jim Jarmusch.
Great movie.
It stars Johnny Depp as William Blake, a 19th century accountant who shares a name with the famous British poet, and who's also on the run after murdering a man. This is one of the quirkiest westerns I've ever seen, and its originality and Depp's performance are definitely its best attributes. I also had to acknowledge a song from one of my favorite bands of the 1990s, the Jayhawks. They released the song Blue that year, and it remains a favorite of mine to this day. I also know that you're a big fan of that song.
I love Blue. It's a great song.
Yeah, great band. Hey, well, that does it for this show. If anyone's interested to learn more about the stuff featured in the episode, the films, music, and TV discussed, please visit our website, kenandcliff.com. You'll find links to additional reading, Spotify song lists, Letterboxd lists, and an opportunity to contact us about what you like and don't like. Next week, we're covering 1976, America's Bicentennial. Be forewarned, this is going to be a long show. For films, we'll be discussing four films: Rocky, Network, All the President's Men, and Taxi Driver.
For TV debuts, we'll discuss Charlie's Angels, Laverne and Shirley, and The Muppet Show. And for music, we'll hear songs from The Eagles, The Sex Pistols, ABBA, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Bob Seger, and Jackson Browne. Please share Yearview Mirror with Ken and Cliff with your friends and family, Buzz and Woody, Xena the Warrior Princess, Tommy Boy.
Can't forget Tommy Boy.
You can always find us on KenandCliff.com and drop us a message about what you like and don't like. Join us next time on Yearview Mirror with Ken and Cliff.